Welcome to the Embodiment Podcast. This show is for you if you see the body as more than a brain taxi. It's for people interested in coming home to the body as a holistic aspect of who we are and how we live. Episodes contain practical tips, exercises you can take away, and interviews with embodiment specialists from around the world. I'm your host, Mark Walsh.
So on the show today, Monica Grace. So Monica is an experienced Alexander Technique teacher, been teaching for quite some while. She's joining us from the south of the USA today. She has a background in theatre and she's director of something called the Poise Project. And I'm sure she'll tell us what that is. So Monica, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's nice to be here.
And how did you get interested in working with the body? What was your entrance into this?
When I was growing up, I lived in the north in New England, and then we moved into the south, and my mother was from Germany, and my father was from Pennsylvania, so I always felt like the home that was most permanent was the south, I guess. That might be how you might term it, and or the most transportable, since I learned to be pretty flexible about not getting too attached to where I was, but more how I was or what I was doing or how I was engaged in things. Looking back, I think that might be it. And I became very interested in, first I wanted to be a writer, and I think that was just the life of the imagination. It was so fascinating, and I really liked explaining things and figuring out how to talk about things, use words in exciting and interesting ways. And then I became interested in theater, and I really found my passion there in acting. And it was a real home. It was a kind of extended family. It seemed, looking back, to open up all of those vistas of what embodiment can offer in human development, which are these senses of being in space and time in a very aware way, having those relationships. Spatially and temporally, both with your own sense of yourself, your organization of yourself and orientation, as well as those relationships with the world around you, particularly the audience relationship in performance. So I think those were probably some of the ways that I developed interest in embodiment. And of course, when I was training to be an actor, I went to North Carolina School of the Arts, which is a university campus devoted entirely to performing arts. It was an experiment in the 1960s, which has never been reproduced anywhere else in the country. It's the only state university campus. It's part of the University of North Carolina system that's devoted entirely to performing arts so that you could get a degree, but you didn't have to be in an academic environment. You could be more in a performative environment. So I think choosing that kind of way of educating myself in the theater was helpful as well. And I gravitated immediately towards movement theater, commedia, mask work, clowning, physical theater, object theater, puppetry, all these kinds of ways of placing experience and relational development in movement and in spatial and temporal relationships. And then after moving to New York and being an actor for a while, I became a director. And I think that again was this interest in relationship and movement and patterns and how those can affect experience. So I'd say that's my background. But in the training, we had Alexander Technique. Yep. And that was how I first had it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of people listening to this might not be aware that kind of theater is an embodied practice. It's not just sort of pretending to be someone or acting. We had a Rachel Blackman talk about this on the show on the earlier episodes. It's a very deep embodied practice for many people.
Yeah. And it was interesting in my training, it was a period where it was an experimental period. I trained in the early 70s. So it'd come out of the experiments of the 60s, and we were a little bit past in the 50s where there had been the method acting and Stanislavski and so forth. And I was really drawn to like Michael Chekhov's work, Joseph Chaykin's work, The Presence of the Actor. I actually studied with Chaykin after I went to New York. And I was always much more able to create performance and character through the body, through movement, through gesture, sometimes from the outside in, some from the inside out, however you would want to tune it. as opposed to kind of intellectually finding out, well, what did this person eat for breakfast and what kind of toothpaste do they use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find if I start moving like someone, I very quickly get kind of insights into who they are, and I might be using that
exactly.
in a coaching context or any other context. Okay, so you talk about the Alexander Technique. We've had a couple of people on from the Alexander Technique. Listeners may or may not have heard those episodes. I just point them to episodes we did with people like Constance and Bruce Furtman for other episodes. But if they haven't heard those, what Bruce is the Alexander Technique?
Yes. I think different people have different ways of talking about it. So I don't want to say this is definitive or this is how everybody would describe Alexander, but it's certainly a very thoughtful one that I've developed over time. And I would say that primarily you can think of Alexander Technique as an educational approach and a cognitive approach, although it focuses on what we would call embodiment or somatics primarily. And that it uses a clear set of learned principles. So you're not learning a system of movement or set pattern of movement. You're learning basic principles which have to do with human functioning. And you can teach any individual these skills, and it allows for conscious control and self-regulation with very heightened awareness, but in a very practical, very down-to-earth way. I sometimes call it the physiology of Buddhism. It's like a very Western approach, but that gives a very open experience and learning process for the person, which might reflect some of the Eastern philosophies. I also study Butoh dance, and some of the experience that you have through engaging with the Alexander principles, particularly in the area of widened awareness, self-awareness, self-orientation is similar to those Eastern disciplines. However, the difference with Alexander is these principles are meant to be engaged with actively in daily life, in the most banal moments of your life, in all activity, all time. It becomes a sort of way of being where you're able to both be aware of what's going on inside, sort of the interoception, the sensations, or the awareness of yourself, as you are carrying out activities and having a relationship with things around you. So once you learn the principles, you begin applying them immediately in your daily life. And over time, you become more adept, more sophisticated in them. And you are becoming what I call a first-person expert. And the teacher is a kind of second-person expert that's helping you become the first-person expert of yourself, the authority of self in a way. And it's very much devoted to the idea of active choice, of always feeling you have options, that you can become aware of your habitual reactions to stimuli, which are, as we know, pretty basic. And often our first reactions are part of that survival part of our system, of our physiology. Our reactions can be fight or flight. They can be very urgent. Everything seems to be, I have to get this done immediately. It's a crisis. Alexander imposes through the personal will a kind of pause to observe those reactions and then to open up that field of choice whenever you choose to. And again, you can choose choice or not. There are plenty of times in life where you're going along and you realize you're heading in a certain direction. And you just go, well, I'll just keep going there, even though I know I am and perhaps I shouldn't. But it allows you to be in charge of those choices in a very active, very practical, very daily way. So I think most profoundly, these principles allow you to, that it's really based on a philosophy or a belief that by learning these principles of human functioning, and with that self-awareness that follows, that human beings can learn, can develop, can grow, can improve throughout their entire arc of their lives, through all the stages of their lives, through all the challenges of their lives, and continue on this trajectory of improvement. And by improvement, I don't mean that you're going to avoid challenges such as illness or all kinds of conditions that we don't have control over, but that you have an awareness of what you do have control over. And this gives you a real deep confidence that you can meet all those unknowns with the ability to manage yourself well and not be overwhelmed by them. So your focus is on what's reliable, the organization of yourself that you have control over, the laws of physics that are have some level of control over you, which are very reliable. Everything else is very unknown. So you could say, ultimately, Alexander Technique takes away, in a very real sense, our fear of falling, our fear of failing, our fear of taking risk. And I think I had sent to you that quote that A.R. Alexander, FM's brother, mm-hmm. had said, which was that the hallmarks of Alexander Technique are creativity, spontaneity, and adaptability to change. And I think those are the most important aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's an educational method rather than corrective. I like that aspect to it. You know, it sounds like it's down to awareness and choice, like so many of the other embodied arts, increasing our awareness of what we do. You know, Feldenkrais would be pretty aligned with that, and having some different choices to be less reactive and more moving, acting, being in a way which is more in line with how we want to be.
Yeah, I think that sometimes people then feel like, well, then you're always calm and you're always cool and you're always, you know, kind of slow and you move easy, but it's not true. You can be very fast and you can be, you know, just, you can do whatever you do normally with a higher level of performance, with more self-awareness and with more commitment.
Mm. I mean, it's a slightly challenging question. If Alexander Technique teachers are so creative, how come you can always see them? You can always spot them.
Like spot the Alexander people?
Yeah. As soon as they walk in a room, you know, there's a certain poise.
What do you spot about them? How do you spot, what's your, what would be in the technical book, how to spot the Alexander teacher?
Well, there's a certain poise, a certain grace, a certain alignment. I always want to go upper class when I do it. And slightly robotic sometimes looking.
Robotic, yeah.
Can be, yeah.
So I think you've put your finger on it, yeah.
A little, I don't see, like, I'm surprised, this quote you sent me, I liked it, but I'm surprised to sort of see creativity in there. It's not something I necessarily associate with some of the Alexander Tech teachers, as I know now. I know it's hard to generalize, there's different schools, etc., but there is a particular look.
I agree, and there's a funny anecdote about that, and we do joke about it in the community, which is sort of the Alexander Android, the Alexandroid, and it's sometimes it's misinterpreted, just that poise, we're not used to seeing people in poise, so it seems false. I remember sitting somewhere, and somebody said, "Doesn't your back hurt when you're sitting that way?" And I said, "What do you mean?" So, well, you're not leaning against the back of the chair. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, my back is my back and it works very well. Thank you. But yes, we do have that issue. In fact, there's a really funny anecdote that in Brighton in, I think it was 1988 or 89, they had an International World Congress of Alexander teachers. And they overheard someone who works, you know, like one of the workers, one of the dining room workers or something, saying, so who are all these people? They asked him, who are all these people here? What are they here for? Oh, they're Alexander, something like this Alexander Technique stuff. They said, well, what's that? I don't know, but they all seem to have something wrong with their necks.
So it kind of, there's from the outside, it can look, I guess the other sense I can sometimes get is it can kind of controlling if you're constantly sort of doing things to yourself, I don't think this is limited to Alexander Technique.
Yeah. You know, basically thinking. I think that can happen in any discipline, any somatic discipline.
Yeah.
I think Alexander Technique, this is my theory. It's my theory that it attracts people who are interested in control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And some who are highly interested in self-control or might need it. You know how it is that in the 60s we used to say your hang-up becomes your trip.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that you're most having difficulty with or your most habitual addiction becomes your job choice later on. So I think that introverts can, a lot of music, because it came from the performing arts,
mm-hmm.
so a lot of musicians did it and often very introverted personalities. Or people that, and so the control aspect was very comforting and became heightened perhaps and unnecessarily got focused on, I can control things inside myself. However, I do think that it is about spontaneity. It's just those people are choosing not to be spontaneous in that moment. That's okay. That's their choice. but there, I think it's conscious.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, just to broaden the question out, you know, to who chooses what art, especially at a time like now where there's so much choice, you can really select an art that perfectly fits your neurosis, can't you, in the kind of modern
yes,
world.
Yes, exactly. That's it.
Mm-hmm. It's not like there's Absolutely. Any one yoga class in town, or, you know, it used to be maybe just AT and Feldenkrais. I mean, now there's 1,000 kinds of body work, and you can, there's so much there. We can really select one which could perfectly sort of fit the what was it you said, the 60s language,
your hang up becomes your trip.
Yeah, so the hang ups can get very carefully selected now in a way which I think is fairly new, and it's hard to separate out cause and effect sometimes from these things, isn't it?
Like, I agree, and it can be that's a level of maybe subconscious habit too. But that's why there's an interesting evolution in Alexander now. Because certainly I think the teachers who came out of maybe more the theater side, like myself, were spontaneity and what we call being in the moment and moment-to-moment choice that you make as an actor when you're developing a scene or a play, that interest went against some of the formality that came from F.M. Alexander's way of teaching in England, which suited that period.
Victorian England
suited
right?
that.
Yeah. It's essentially teaching in Victorian England. I mean, that's a pretty.
It was actually Edwardian, but Edwardian. Same difference, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so it was also a very elite population, a very well-heeled population that could afford to take a month off and go and visit Mr. Alexander in London and learn his things. When it came to America, I think, as you know, we're a little bit more loose, and I think some of the ways of teaching, some of the ideas of teaching changed. And what we really started to discover were these underlying principles did not need to be taught exactly in the same way. There's a lot of controversy, there still is, in how you teach it. Is it this traditional way of teaching it, or are there other ways, which would be an interest of mine. And I think the actors got very upset with kind of being told to get in and out of a chair and stand and sit. And
yeah.
And they said, wait a minute, we're here to learn how to, you know, move freely and do unexpected things. And gradually there were more and more teachers coming from the theater world who brought new ideas and group teaching and so forth. So I think it's really evolved. I think it's a very different thing now than perhaps what had happened even 10, 20 years ago.
And then this is an interesting question. It's not just the nature of an art, but also who does it. Like, you know, Alexander Technique is heavily influenced by theatre. Feldenkrais has a heavy dance influence. You know, you talked about Butoh earlier, sort of another form of dance. So, you know, I don't know who does that. But it seems like, you know, different body works, different arts get associated with different groups of people who do them. You know, for example, Aikido is an art that I've been involved with. It has quite a strong number of sort of geeky computer people who do it. It just seems
to work that way. Because I know a lot of theater people who love Aikido, you know.
There's different styles and different groups, but it's quite interesting, like the influence on from the people who bring, you know, where they come from. Like, we talk about culture quite a lot on this show. You're the first person we've had, I think, from any of the southern states. You know, often sort of stuff from the States comes from California, maybe Boulder. I think you're the first. I know we get quite a lot of listeners in Kansas and in Austin, Texas, which I understand is a bit of a sort of liberal island. You know, how is it teaching there as well? I'd be curious to hear about that.
That would get us to talking a little bit about this nonprofit that, you know, I launched with some other people called the Poise Project. My background is, I guess I, you know, if you want to talk about it socioeconomically, was sort of lower middle class. But I went to college and both my parents managed to get to college. My father grew up in the Depression, sort of the first person to go to college in his family, that kind of thing. So I always have felt more of, you know, I think a lot of somatic disciplines have catered a lot to the more upper middle class or even upper classes that had disposable income and could go on retreats and was very self-focused. I think you might compare it in Buddhism to, the Hiragana path and the Mahayana path. It was always about how can this help people? How can this influence society? How can this help us become better together? How can it lift someone out of suffering? And maybe because I was raised Unitarian Universalist, maybe because I, you know, my parents had these harsh experiences in their lives, the depression for my father, World War II in Germany for my mother. It just spoke to me that this was a work that was for everyone. And so the Poise Project was started because I was, first of all, frustrated that when you talked about Alexander in the general public, people would say, "What is that?" over and over and over and over again. After 125 years of it being around, I said, there's something off here. So I thought, well, what can I do? And I did a lot of research about why that might be and identified certain barriers and created a strategic model that we're using. I call it a 12-step program against Alexander Anonymous. And it's a way of just bringing this back to the most basic idea that this is a right for everyone to know this information. This shouldn't be some kind of elite thing you learn on retreats, right?
Money, though, right? I mean, in terms of, like, I took, I think, 8 Alexander Technique lessons last year, which was fantastic. I recommend it to people. Good teacher called Mark in Brighton. Lots of good teachers in Brighton.
Kamal? Yes, he's very nice.
Yeah, so I had a teacher at 8 Lessons with Mark, and he gave me a sort of discount for 8 lessons. He gave me some sort of deal, but it was still a few hundred pounds because, you know, one-to-one, he's a professional and no disrespect for him, rightly so, you know, he needs to earn a living. And, you know, that's a pretty big barrier, even though we could look at it as a long-term investment because it's educational, it's educating me in a certain way. And, you know, a lot of the stuff was really good, basic somatic stuff that I think could serve anyone. Yeah, but that format of a kind of series of one-to-one lessons, and as I understand it, FM and Exxon, it may have been a month of lessons every day. You know, it's 30.
Yeah, which was a very nice way of learning something, having an intensive. I mean, we all know doing intensives is very effective, but it's not necessarily something that the general public can do. Mm. Yes, and that's the main barrier, is that I would say almost 100%, let's say 95% of Alexander teaching is done private practice, private pay. There's some work, let's say I had it because it was part of my theater training. You know, had I not had that, I doubt I would have been able to necessarily afford private lessons or even know they existed. But that being said, the difference about Alexander and a lot of other learning, somatic learning, is that it is something that the whole goal of learning is so that you can become independent of the teacher.
Yes,
and it is a little bit of a gradual process, right? You start off with a lot of lessons close together, perhaps spread them out more and more and more, and then you're really independent and you're learning on your own. You're applying these for yourself. That's the goal. It's a little bit different than a lot of other practices, certainly different than something like massage. So it's not well understood, but then it should be something that is readily available, that the teacher gets paid what's necessary for them to have their living, but it could be subsidized through insurance or through other programming, or it could be taught in elementary, what you would call primary schools, secondary, tertiary schools, in college. I always thought it would be a great freshman college course for all freshmen in colleges to have Alexander work at that point, a semester of it, you know, when they're making that transition from living at home with their mom and dad to going out in the world, and it's daunting. So they'd have more success in their college years and moving forward. I had my lessons when I was 19. I can't imagine my life without this information.
I think this is a great question. We can jump in. Like, how do we, you know, get somatic education? I think anyone that listens to this show has an interest in this. You know, there's so many different forms out there. But, you know, good quality somatic education, make it widespread. That's been one of my life missions. Yeah. One of my answers has been this podcast. Another one has been the YouTube channel. You know, I've found the internet to be a great way to scale things. And, you know, this will be listened to by several thousand people, which is fantastic, you know. Which is a great use of an hour of our time, right? But there's only so much you can do on these sort of scalable platforms.
That's why you have to have a kind of consistent and collaborative and group effort. So as a profession, Alexander hasn't really done that, hasn't sort of gathered together people to focus on specific barriers and solve those barriers and also be in communication with one another while they're doing it. And that's the infrastructure that I hope the POISE Project is and has become.
What do you do? What do you do with the POISE Project? Give me an example of I've got the website here. I'm going to look at it. It looks cool.
What? Sure. Again, anytime you have a strategic approach to solve a problem and you're working with people who are free-spirited somatic experiencers, there's a bit of conflict of interest, right? So I'm pretty, I am not an entrepreneur. I am not a business-minded person. But you, if you want to bring work to a wide variety of people, you need to be able to translate that work accurately into new cultures and languages. And by that, I mean new populations and new communities and new industries. So a big part of the barrier with Alexander work, and maybe with a lot of somatic disciplines, is the language we use.
Yep.
Our assumption is everyone wants to be free and everybody wants to explore and everybody wants to discover language, which is very theater oriented, very performing arts oriented. And unconsciously, I think as Alexander teachers, we really develop that kind of language because that was where Alexander came from. That's what our, the main teaching we do, and the teachers came out of that world. But if you go to a, let's say, a physical therapist, and you start talking about freeing their neck, they're just going to leave the room. So that's a big part of the POISE Project is speaking to people from within these other populations or the people who are going to connect us to populations. If I want to work with a person with Parkinson's and give them Alexander training, I need to get through a lot of connectors to get to them. For instance, their neurologist or movement disorder specialist needs to have some level of confidence in what I'm doing if they're going to refer patients. And allied health professionals such as occupational therapists or physiotherapists need to kind of understand what we're, what it is that we're doing and what our role is. So just defining what I say, I use the language, defining the role of the Alexander specialist in patient care. That's a talk I do, right?
Yeah.
That makes, that bristles a lot of Alexander teachers because they say, well, that makes it look like you're doing therapy or you're a therapist.
Yeah.
I said, no, we're just defining our role as being different than what a PT does, what an OT does, what a massage therapist would be offering. Let's be clear what we do and what we don't do and where we fit in what they now call the interdisciplinary care team. Another model would be in schools. You're not going to speak about, you know, patient care when you're going in to speak with a principal in an administrative situation. You're going to use education language. You're going to use developmental, you know, child development language. How do we fit in those specialized needs that they have in schools?
Yeah.
And so you have to find out what the perceived need is of the people who are going to hire you if you want to get to that child.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few things here I'd love to dig into and just bounce around with a bit. So I found this language issue to be critical. I wrote a book called How to Work in Business, A Guide for Hippies. It's a little ebook online.
That's it. That's it exactly. That's it in a nutshell.
But in business, there's a certain language, but even then within business, we've got industries and, you know, I tech industry, I use certain analogies, for example, that I wouldn't use in an engineering kind of company, you know. There's different, like we've talked generationally already, you know, some of the sort of, what was the, your trip becomes your what was
your
it?
Hang up, your hang up, what your neurosis is becomes your job.
I have to translate that in my head because I'm from a different generation. And if I'm talking to a 20-year-old hipster, that's different again because I'm an old man to him, you know? And and then there's cultural, like a lot of West Coast American language disgusts me at a deep level. And, you know, the South is kind of...
That's okay. You can inhibit your reaction.
I do. The vomit's not coming up. And then, like, I, you know, in the South of America, that's different again, right? And then we've got politically, like, left and right. Like, generally, this stuff is done by people on the left. And language like free and expression, you know, conservatives just hear danger when they hear those words. So a conservative hears, that's like, free expression, and, you know, free this and expressive that. And they're just like... okay, I don't want that. Like, what I like is, like what you were talking about earlier, like control and, you know, maybe discipline or there's other words that would be more appealing.
What is their perceived need and how are you meeting it? At the same time that, you know, I use the metaphor Alexander technique, let's say it's a really big house It has lots of doors, and you want to put lots of different welcome mats in front of those doors. But when people come inside, they're learning the same thing, but you're teaching an individual from a particular societal culture.
Yeah.
And that's how you have to meet them.
Yeah.
You have to meet them where they live.
I love the idea of welcome mats, and perceived needs really critical here. It's like, what's the problem?
It's a perceived need. It's not the need I think they have. It's the need they feel they have.
Yeah. So we've already got nationality. We could talk about social class. We could talk about region. We could talk about generation. We could talk about industry. You know, we've already talking like this fairly complex kind of set of things to consider. And it's really nice.
It is complex.
One size doesn't fit, at least with the welcome mat, even if the work is, you know, we're all human, right? So there's a universality often to the work. But in terms of both the language to welcome, to appeal, this is marketing. You're essentially talking about good marketing, really. And also the...
In a way, yes. You could say that. It's also, if you want to look at it with a more sociological point of view or compassionate point of view, it's just caring for the people that you want to care for. You know, if you really cared about that child who's in that school, you'd do anything you could to reach them, even if it means getting to a gatekeeper and presenting a budget that you would never have thought you would have had to be able to write.
Well,
if you really care about that child, you have to do it.
You just reframed how I put it for a liberal audience, you know, like that was a good example of what you're talking about. So if I'm talking about, hey, that's great marketing, and you know full well that a load of people listening to this are going to be turned off by that word, that's going to be a dirty word for them, then to talk about it in terms of how you care and how you get to those people. And I completely agree with you on this. I'd also say...
And there's no difference in the end result in some ways, right?
Yeah.
It's getting, it's serving a purpose. What is your purpose? And it doesn't mean, you know, some people would say, well, you know, then you lose ethics. Obviously, we want to be ethical and moral. But it's about what is, you know, if you're a teacher of Alexander Technique, who do you want to benefit? Who do you want to teach?
Yeah.
And how are you going to accomplish that? And you may have to, first of all, solicit help. There's a very important role in our 12-step process, which I call the advocate translator. That's like you. You know how to translate a bit between the experiential or somatic process of learning or experiencing somatic disciplines and a business corporate environment.
Mm.
You would be someone who we could talk to and say, could you please translate this document into corporate for us? You know, it's necessary. I wouldn't go to France and expect not only that I didn't have to speak French, but that I didn't have to learn about how to be what the proper manners are. If you're going in and you're teaching Alexander in a corporate environment, you're not going to be able to go there in your nice tie-dye outfit with your, you know, bell bottoms from the 60s. You're going to have to find the suit and tie. You're going to have to understand what the visuals are that make people comfortable in their learning.
Yeah, I think this is really the issue for embodiment teachers generally of our age. I feel like the mindfulness people have led the way really in this, and it's that the embodiment people are playing catch up in terms of translating. You know, I literally emailed a client earlier today, and I'm within Moscow in a few weeks, saying, what's the dress code there? Will everyone be in a suit? Because it's also
possible. It's very important. That's very important.
So, like, there's something as simple. I've taken students shopping. I've said, you know what? All you need is one good suit. I'll help you. I'll take you shopping. And it's like, okay, you need this. So where's the language? It's how we dress. It's how we knock on the doors, the brochures, the quality of the business card. There's all kinds of factors here. And I feel like that there's something actually really...
Unless you're going into a touchy-feely environment... People like to roll around on the floor, and then you better not wear that suit.
Exactly.
Right?
Like when I work with humanitarian aid workers, if I come in a suit, that's going to be just a terrible idea. Then they need different language. And, you know, even some groups I swear with, some groups I don't. There's a whole way in which, you know, there's the examples you use. There's all sorts of factors here. But it's really nice you're doing that. I really appreciate that this, you're sort of translating.
Yeah, and it doesn't change the teaching. I mean, if you believe in these principles of Alexander Technique, and we can talk, you know, speak about them specifically, but then you want, the principle is sound. How you teach it can change, can shift. according to the level of understanding, which gets us back. I never really answered your question about teaching in the South or bringing this work to the South. So what we've done right now, I'll give you specifics of a POISE project. We have a number of initiatives. We're trying to do a different initiative each year. And the first initiative was with a 10-year, I see it as a 10-year project, basically. And the 10-year initiative is AT for children and youth, because I think that's just fundamental. You know, why do triage later on with people when you can, when they can have this inside them from the beginning as much as possible? So our first initiative was Alexander Technique for Parkinson's, for a few different reasons. The first was that there already is a body of research, very good research that's been done about AT as an intervention to help people with their motor symptoms with Parkinson's. Secondly, there's an incredibly motivated population, both from the care, the people living with Parkinson's diagnosis, mm-hmm. and their care partners are very motivated. They participate, they ask for services, they create services, they teach peer-to-peer, they have support groups and so forth. So that works well with Alexander. I make the comparison in the health industry that an Alexander teacher is closer to like a nutritionist who recommends things for you to eat and shows you how to make them, but can't guarantee you actually follow through on it. In a way, the Alexander teacher is teaching you good practices and how you can manage yourself well and choices you can make that are better and healthy. No guarantee people will actually use that information well in there and integrate it. So right now, our first, we applied for a grant from the Parkinson's Foundation here last year, which we received, a $25,000 grant to deliver a course for care partners, what you would call carers, of people living with Parkinson's. And it's a 10-week course. It meets for 90 minutes once a week over a 10-week period. And during the course of that, they build up their self, the resilience of self, because the studies that have been done about caregiver burnout are termed under the ebris of loss of self. When you're caring for someone, you merge with their needs and you begin to lose your own sense of self. And so Alexander is very useful at retaining a sense of self, even while you're caring or going through these challenges of managing someone else's illness. So that course right now in North Carolina is being delivered. We're doing it at 8 sites around the state. And the people that we're reaching are people who would probably never go to an Alexander lesson, never be exposed to it. And they are, they're like absorbing these principles like that. They love it. It's going very well. We have high retention. People aren't dropping out of these classes. And yet, if I had shown maybe this group to my colleagues, some of my colleagues, they would say, oh, they're never going to learn Alexander. They're not going to be interested in it. They're not going to be able to.
It was group work you were doing as well, because that immediately changed.
And we're testing group models. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's, mm-hmm. Yoga used to be taught entirely one-to-one. And then, you know, Iyengar came along and said, hey, you can actually do this in groups. And that immediately made it much more scalable kind of right
Even
there.
In India? In India, yeah. It was taught one-to-one?
Yeah, always one-to-one or one-to-two or three. And it was only the students of Krishnamacharya that started doing classes at the Mysore Palace and then Iyengar with Westerners. So it was always, you know, a student. And like Tai Chi, often martial arts, there'd be a teacher that would show a student one or two things and you'd have to go away and work on it. The sort of group class format's fairly novel invention.
Yeah, I think sometimes because of issues of class and education and economics, we sometimes have attitudes about one another which need to be really dealt with. And again, I think it's meeting people where they are and having the expectation that this is something useful for them and not having the expectation that they're going to be. I listened to your first podcast, you talked about Alexander somehow in the cult, right? I think anything can become cultish.
Okay.
And certainly our profession has that potential. And that means that some people are excluded, right? They're just never going to make the grade.
Yeah.
And I just feel so deeply that this is just part, this is about human agency. It's a right to know about your physiology and about choice and about awareness and consciousness and how it can prevent you from getting, you know, suffering from having a hip replacement by the time you're 50, because you've worked in a factory or you've worked in a warehouse lifting boxes, or you're a truck driver, lorry driver, you know. I mean, why can't that person get this information? And why is it not okay that they simply take three lessons, get what they need from it, and go on with their lives and prevent maybe, and recover from their hip surgery better than they would have if they hadn't had those three lessons? I have no problem with that. I don't think they need to become, you know, monks and nuns of Alexander.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. We don't all have to be super, you know, dedicated kind of practitioners. And I don't think Alexander's the worst when it comes to being a cult leader by far, not by any means.
No, not at all.
And well, we just cover for that. There's still something straightforward about Alexander. I think, you know, it's called technique.
I mean, it's very practical. It's just very practical and useful and upfront, and it's not, you know, pie in the sky. Which in some ways is why it sometimes invokes control and what you see, that appearance that you see. Because that's fun. That is kind of our basic form. And then there are variations on it. And the actor likes to do the variations. And most people, let's say the violinist, likes...
Because musicians are the other people that really work with it a lot, don't they? You know, musicians are often trained in it as well. It's another group, isn't it?
And I think the majority of teachers come from a music background more than a theater background.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I wonder how that affects it. You know, musicians who do endless scales and sort of, you know, lots of practice every day.
And by musicians, I mean singers as well. You know, singers and instrumentalists, yeah.
All classical though, right? You're not talking about rock guitarists.
Mostly classical, yes. Less the jazz side of things, right? Just like... In the theater, maybe it was part of the theater. I'm sorry, what, Mark?
I said not the hip hop side of things. Like, you talk about music, like it's all, you know, jazz and classical. It's like, come on, there's
The hip hop. Not yes, exactly. But I'm thinking more about what would be in a conservatory training program, and where they might come in touch with Alexander. I know most hip hop people do not go to a conservatory training program, but a lot of jazz artists do.
Sure.
So that's where they might have come in contact with Alexander work.
Okay, and then you've got a class thing right there, right? Look at sort of class influences on it. I think the Americans tend to underdo class very strongly in their considerations. And
we have more access to education, and it's more like, you know, it's just, but there are still attitudes. I mean, if you go to Yale and Harvard and Princeton, that's one thing. And, you know, there's a good support system for the rest of your life.
You have a class system. I think it's worse than ours. I think ours looks less flexible, but is actually better. But I think it's just a blind spot. I don't think it's that it's better there. But I mean, I don't think classes talks a lot about, you know, if you look at Alexander technique as, I don't want to pick on AT because I do like it, but there's a certain sort of upper class leaning to, you talked about conservatoires and, you know, violinists and things like this. It's, I'm not really joking about the sort of lack of hip hop in it.
That's one of the big aspect, big part of the mission of Alexander Technique is that it's about diversity. If we look around at an Alexander conference, it's a lot of, you know, white, upper middle class people. And in order to have diversity amongst our pupils or students, if you will, or clients, you're going to have diversity amongst your teachers. And it has to, people want to work with people from their community. Yeah. So it's, that's key, and that has to change. And again, this is all part of the same aspect of meeting people where they are and not having an expectation of what the Alexander teacher needs to be, or what they need to look like, or what they need to sound like.
There's something humble and about sort of putting the client's need and client's language and, you know, first, isn't there? I think it's almost sort of autistic, without being unfair to autistic people. There's also something slightly, maybe egocentric's a better word, to be fair.
Slightly?
Autistic or egocentric about sort of saying, look, I want to do it this way because I'm an Aikido teacher, or because I'm a Alexander teacher, or whatever the modality is. I want to talk generally. And actually something sort of humble and wonderful about saying, okay, well, what is it you're looking for and how do you speak?
Right. I'm here for you. If I'm a teacher and a second person expert, it's to help someone become a first person expert. It's not to build up my first person expertise in the room. And I think that sometimes, you know, this is a theory I have with how Alexander teachers become teachers. First of all, when we meet this work, it's always... the first meeting of it is for us. We're becoming first person experts. It's transforming our lives. And then we go, you know, maybe I'll go along and be a teacher. And some people's motivation is to continue improving themselves. And it's a big focus in Alexander training. But ultimately, if you're training to be a teacher, at some point really has to shift. The focus has to shift from your expertise. The reason you're becoming more of a first person expert and more, better and better expertise of your own use is so that you can help other people.
Yeah.
And then that's what the Poise Project is trying to do, is saying there are plenty of Alexander focus and membership organizations focused on the needs of the teachers, focused on qualifications, focused on those professional, collegial, peer to peer issues. But there aren't any that are focused on looking out at the public and saying, you come to me, you tell me what you need, you lead us towards other people with Parkinson's. So when we put together a team to solve on our initiatives, in the leadership positions, first of all, we want people from that population who've benefited from Alexander and want to advocate for it. And they're advocating peer-to-peer. That's our goal. Secondarily, it would be people from within the industry, like a movement disorder specialist who's experienced Alexander and wants to advocate for it to her peers. And thirdly are the Alexander teachers who have expertise working with that population, and they're leading the way too. So we're trying to give up a little bit of that control and really let our students, the general public, the civilians, if you will, lead the work out into the world. I think that has to happen.
Yeah, you're talking about being of service, really, isn't it? And it's natural that people start serving themselves, because otherwise, that's why you go to a practitioner, why you start doing Aikido, or whatever it is that you want to serve yourself. And then there's also trap for the artist, I'd say, in particular, getting caught in extended self-development junkie as well, getting caught in extended self-development without looking of service. So I find it quite interesting. One of the first groups you said you've been working with is people who have almost lost that sense of self. They've kind of, they're so orientated around serving others. And I see this in nurses, I see this in charity workers, I see this in mothers. Particularly mothers, sometimes fathers, more mothers, if I'm honest. And
women tend to be more absorbed and more likely to lose a sense of self.
Yeah, lost in the other in there. There's a cultural factor there, isn't there? And it's very interesting that somatic practices can be used to sort of firm up that sense of self. And it's almost like, I hear us both basically agreeing, saying, we need to move the emphasis away for some extent from practitioners. But then, there's certain groups out there that are so giving, they've lost that sense of self, which is a fairly foreign concept to me as someone who does work on myself every day, meditates every day, has got yoga planned this evening. I'm not in a great mood today. I'm fairly a bit down today, which is not your fault in any way. But I'm aware of that. There's a self-awareness there. Like, this is how I am today. And I feel like it's quite foreign for people in our world to imagine even sort of completely losing one's sense of self and being so caught in service to the other, which is very common amongst nurses, for example.
Yeah, and well, with the care partners that we're talking about, they're what we would call the informal care partner. In other words, the wife or the husband or the daughter or the son, usually, who are in charge of managing the care or are just thrust into that position. It was identified, they didn't even start studying this phenomenon of caregiving until the 1980s. There was a sociologist and researcher named Leonard Perlin. During the AIDS epidemic, he began studying that informal networks of care that the AIDS communities, or the gay communities, were managing because so many people had been ostracized by their families. So there was this care network that was built up, and he was very fascinated by it, so he began to study that. And then that moved into him studying people who were caring for people with Alzheimer's disease. And that's when he began to identify this issue of loss of self and burnout and things like that. Nobody even cared to research this until the 1980s. It's phenomenal. Mostly, I think, because it was being done by women. It was just assumed that the wife would take care of the person with the illness, and it's unpaid, it's untrained, and it's unsupported labor. It's saving societies millions and millions of pounds, if you will, or dollars every year, and it's taking an incredible toll. It's just this expectation, oh, your husband now has this diagnosis, off you go,
It's sort of untrained. A friend of mine, Tao Vajra, he does mindfulness breaks for carers, but they're not professional carers. They're people who can't walk away, and many of them are men.
That's right. That's who we're teaching. Those are the people that we're working with. I don't know if I had been clear first.
It's incessant hard work that they're not trained for, which is, you know, potentially emotionally very damaging. So I can see, you know, or certainly potentially draining. So I can see why.
And they're often, in this case with the Parkinson's, they're elderly. They themselves have issues with pain and with mobility. This is the time of life where they thought they'd be going off on a cruise, and they're instead taking care of an invalid, or not an invalid, I don't want to say that, but dealing with this progressive condition. Now, that's not to say there aren't people who have early onset, so there's very young people who have Parkinson's as well. It can reach any age. Mm-hmm. But the point that we're making is that the Alexander work is something that can really help that person in the moment recover themselves over and over and over again all day long.
Mm. And, you know, it's difficult to be, a lot of these people are in later years earning this, and you'll see a sort of 70-year-old helping an elder 80-year-old kind of thing. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, it's great if they can be learning things later in life. And it's also, I kind of, you know, I feel like today I kind of need a vision for how the world can be a better place. And this is the mood I'm in today. And I'm imagining a world where it's normal that young people are taught these skills just as part of their high school, for example, or you talked about freshman year, you know, first year university, where it's just the sort of normal part of education. You know, I really imagine a world, and it doesn't have to be a huge amount of hours, you know, in the same way as the average secondary school kid has, you know, they have music, they have art, they have maths, they have science. They're already doing 10 different subjects. You know, it'll be subject number 11, you know.
That's right.
It's not that, it would only have to be a couple of hours a week, but a couple of hours a week for your entire secondary school, well, that adds up. Do you know what I mean? And people could really get some training, or a couple of hours a week through 2 or 3 years of high school. You could really get some life training in terms of just so many useful skills that can be taught. Yeah, Alexander, but there's other modalities out there, obviously, as well.
And later in life, when people meet these principles, you hear them over and over saying, why didn't they teach me this in school? Why didn't I learn this years ago? Yeah. Why did I have to have back pain for so long when a few simple bits of information could have really helped me manage this or avoid it altogether?
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. And it's, I don't know, just nice. I just invite everyone listening to this to hold that as a vision, that this is something that could be endemic in the world, could be normal in the world.
It's just normal information about how we function. I mean, and it's not rocket science. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. And, you know, again, when you know about it, then it's a question of knowledge. Once you know something, you know it. And then it's just a matter of choice of doing what you know is you can or not. And then, you know, you'd never don't not know it. So then it becomes a matter of choice.
The analogy I'd have is, like, at one time there was a very small priestly class who could read and write, and most people couldn't. And now that's unimaginable to us. Like it's like, you know, swimming or cycling, or, you know, most people can read and write now. And if you couldn't, that's like, okay, really sad and a bit odd and unusual. And maybe there's some sort of, you know, adult education for that, but vast majority of people learn to read and write, and I, you know, literacy is just there. I think this could be considered a kind of emotional embodied literacy.
I think this is like human literacy. I agree. That's a great analogy. There was a time where literacy was power, right? And now we you can see, like in America right now, chipping away at education, you know, and facts, and, you know, all of the things that education helps counterbalance ignorance and so forth. Chipping away at it is a conscious act to maintain power structures. Yeah. So I think that this literacy of embodiment or somatics or human functioning or physiology or however you want to term it is a basic human right. It's like being able to read. You should have that. It should be available to everyone.
And the challenge I would sort of just put to everyone listening to this, I'm aware there's, you know, wide listenership, is that, you know, are we simply part of a kind of ruling priestly class? And we might not be certainly financially in charge of the world, but, you know, we have a certain skill set, which puts us into a certain, you know, place. And we, you know, and you see the yoga teacher who becomes, now I'm the latest yoga teacher or whatever it is, dance teacher or whatever. But are we, you know, are we simply maintaining a priestly class, or are we actually helping the world become more literate? I think that's
a very good point. Yes. And that's one of the things I was feeling that was underlying the Alexander professional world, but was unconscious. I don't think it was deliberate. I think it had just evolved that way. And it's like a wake up. You have to wake up, look around you. Who's in the room with you? Who do you want to be in the room with you?
Yeah, this is one thing I think you know you ghastly colonials are quite good at, is kind of not ignore essentially that the class system. Alexander Tenney was very British upper class kind of class system that was inherited, and I wonder if the sort of new world mentality is a little bit healthier around some of this stuff and bashing down some of those. So I wonder if we haven't just replicated a new class system, and I'm really happy to see, you know, this project, and I know there's others, you know, mindfulness has done it. There's other projects like this, community yoga projects. There's Carol Horton we had on talking about sort of doing yoga in different places. So this movement does seem to be growing. So as we move towards
climate. And I think your metaphor, your example, I should say, of literacy is very useful too, in the level of meeting people where they are. In other words, with literacy, you're not going to take a 5-year-old and give them War and Peace. You're going to give them a picture book, and you're going to have it with a certain amount of words they can understand. They feel successful, and so forth. In the same way with Alexander work and these principles, which are very profound principles, you know, you're just going to meet the age or the level of ability of that person at that time in their life. And with the expectation, I remember this very clearly from one of my early teachers who trained me to teach, was you want to give a lesson in Alexander where the student is successful, where they have a sense of successfulness.
Yep.
Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges, but that they've been successful at least observing their difficulty at something and say, yes, that's very good that you notice that that's hard for you.
And this is one reason yoga's done really well, is the bar to perceive success is actually quite low. Like, most people can do the basic postures, though not all. And I think that is worth noting. As an Aikido teacher, I always used to let the students throw me. I used to make sure their technique was, I taught them to a level where they could throw me, at least basically. And then they'd have that nice feeling, and then they want to come back, and then we could refine the technique further from there. But without that basic experience of success.
Yeah, you want to give them something right away that they're interested in. I say you have to teach to the person's curiosity, not to your curiosity. And I do think, again, that's the issue of the first person expert not really becoming the second person expert. You know, my interest in Alexander and what turns me on and what works for me is quite different than what would work for you or for someone else necessarily. So I have to teach to your curiosity, not my curiosity.
Okay, so we need to wrap this up. I have a bag to pack to go to Kiev and a newsletter to write before the days.
Well, you are very... very important.
I am very important. I'm on the road to Kiev to go to a cheap dentist. That's how important I am. So,
good luck with that.
I have family in the Ukraine and also cheap dentistry. So that's my important reason to go there. But we do need to wrap things up. And in terms of finding out more, they can go to thepoiseproject.org, right?
Yes, it is the word the is part of the URL, thepoiseproject.org. And then my personal website, which is more just about, you know, my husband's a Pilates instructor. And so we have a website called formfitnessfunction.com, all one word.
Got it.
But the Poise Project, I would love people to go in there, join the newsletter, give us feedback, be in contact with me with your ideas. Maybe if any of the things I was talking about intrigued you, or that you felt like you wanted to make a contribution, particularly if you're an Alexander instructor, but anyone, or if you benefit, particularly if you're someone who's benefited from AT and is not a teacher and wants to advocate for it, please contact me. Please reach out to me.
Great. Thank you. Cool project. Nice to hear about. Do you have a closing message about the body for our listeners?
You've used the term a lot of times about that it's not a brain transportation device. Was that the term you used?
Brain taxi. That's from Francis Bryer's.
A brain taxi. Okay. I think that I like to think of it a little bit as if it's transporting anything, it's transporting our fingers. In other words, we got upright because we wanted to feel, to touch, to explore, to learn through hands. And so that's pleasurable. There's satisfaction. There's so much positive. If you sense yourself with confidence that you have these things that are reliable, that you sense yourself as something that's reliable and consistent, you're more likely to take risks. You lose that fear of falling, and you might discover what we say in Alexander Technique, the enjoyment of floating.
Monica, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome to the Embodiment Podcast. This show is for you if you see the body as more than a brain taxi. It's for people interested in coming home to the body as a holistic aspect of who we are and how we live. Episodes contain practical tips, exercises you can take away, and interviews with embodiment specialists from around the world. I'm your host, Mark Walsh.